Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing great.
You now?
I am.
Now, what are you doing tonight?
I'm going to work in the restaurant like almost every single other night of my life.
You sure you don't want to take the night off and come with me?
I'm not sure. Tell me where you're going.
Well, you see, the Friendly Sons of the Shillelagh Social Club in West Orange, New Jersey, is giving Irish dancing lessons tonight.
Now I'm sure. I'm not coming.
My girlfriend had a similar response, but I'm working on her. Similar response.
I would like my feet removed, or would you? I think I choose...
All right, we have the holiday. My family we call the high, and for my family the high holy days are March, the month of St. Patrick's Day among Irish Americans. That is often how we refer to March, and we have coming up, St. Patrick's Day parades and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I would go over real Irish bars. There was an article in Time Out New York about they often have the readers send in and ask questions. And the question is, I'm fed up with all the plastic Irish bars. I want a real Gaelic night out. Where can I go?
And you said Dublin.
Well, you know, my cousin... exactly. No, but there are a lot of real Irish bars. And the funny thing is, like the Italian restaurants that are, you know, staffed by guys who aren't Italian and making food that's not Italian.
And ubiquitous. And, all
like,
over.
Okay, that doesn't mean... And there are some real Irish bars out there. And there's a reason that they're so imitated, okay? Because the real ones are a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And so there was... I don't know if you know this. My cousin... Ronan O'Dowd built an Irish bar in Sunnyside, Queens, and it was the bar was a very Irish community, an Irish American community, and it was a restaurant and bar. I went there many times, and they redid the whole thing, built a huge bar restaurant, thousands of square feet. And it's just and it was great. It was open for a couple of months, burned to the ground.
Uh oh.
You ready for this? The Dunkin' Donuts next
door. Was it Catholic or Protestant?
It was. Don't go there. You don't want to go there. You don't even know what you're talking about. It is going to be a fight.
Just go ahead.
Don't go there. So the Catholic. The bar. But the bar was next to a Dunkin' Donuts. You ready for this? Now it's this beautiful bar. I mean, it's a monstrous beautiful bar restaurant in the center of community. It was the best bar in Sunnyside.
Uh-huh.
The Dunkin' Donuts next door, here's the nature of the restaurant business, hadn't put their coffee burner on right, hadn't vented it properly, and so a little fire started in the wall between the bar, and it burned for hours, because it burned in the wall, went up to the rafters, burned on top. This bar could hold hundreds of people, okay? It was the afternoon for lunch. There were only a few people in there like, I smell smoke. I looked in the kitchen was very smoky. I said, okay, let's get out and call the fire department. As soon as they got out, because the whole roof had been on fire, and so it all came down underneath, burned to the ground. Anyway, so that was, you can't go there. You can't go to that Irish bar.
But, so do you have it? Thank you for that great recommendation. Perhaps you have one that still exists that we can all go
there. Here's an Irish story for you. Well, let's start here in New Jersey. You can go to an Irish American place. It's not really an Irish bar. The Friendly Sons of the Shillelagh Social Club is my social club in West Orange, New Jersey. And the St. Patrick's Day parade season is coming up, and you can actually get some good food in an Irish bar in Maplewood at a place called St. James Gate, which is
I know the place. I've been there.
They have a hearth, they have a lovely bar, they have great Guinness, and they have really good food. So we're recommending St. James Gate.
And they have a snook.
And they have a snug. Which is, Mark always makes fun of me and my Irish relatives. There is, you know, the tradition, I don't know if of course, you may know this if you're a bar goer, but if you've ever heard the expression tucked into the snug, a snug is a place that is in an Irish bar, in a traditional Irish bar, would be off to the side or in the back, and it would often be a private room. Sometimes it would have a door. Traditionally in the Irish bar, the snug is where... when they first allowed women into a bar, a woman wouldn't want to be seen in a bar, so she would go in and be in the snug. Or if the clergy, you know, I don't know if you realize this, but Irish, even Irish priests once in a while go.
Oh, do they? Yeah. They tipple a few.
But they, your Irish accent is awful. It's as bad as my French.
And they go to the snug to be as snug as a bug in a rug, do they?
You're an idiot. But if I didn't find you so amusing, I'd be offended. But traditionally that's where the clergy would go, and that's where the snug comes from.
And hide from the commoners. Is
well,
that?
No, they wouldn't want to be seen. You know, the priest wouldn't want to be seen getting drunk in the bar, which in my culture still happens. They just didn't want to be seen getting drunk in public. Anyway, but here in New York we have a few. We'll list them on our website. There's the Cuckoo's Nest on Woodside Avenue in Queens, if you want to go out to Queens. There's Sean Ogg's Tavern, also on Woodside Avenue. There's the Rambling House on Katona Avenue in Woodlawn in the Bronx. Notice these aren't in Manhattan. And there's Rory Dolan's. You can tell that's an Irish place.
Rory or the Dolan's that gave it away?
In Yonkers. Rory Dolan's is really good. And there's Irish music there in all sorts of places. I want to point out one other place that's sort of somewhere between a real Irish bar and not a real Irish bar. There's a place called Tiernanog. That's
hard to spell. I thought you were going to say Mustang Sally's.
No. There's a place called Tiernanog, Tirnanog, Tiernanog, which is the land of eternal youth in Irish mythology. And there's a Tiernanog in, I think there's one in Philadelphia, and I think there's one in Washington, all the same owners, but the Tiernanog in New York is right across the street from Penn Station, mm-hmm. and Madison Square Garden, of course. And it's in a hotel. It's in the first floor of a hotel. So you would think, Irish bar.
Hotel bar, right.
But it is, the guys who own it took a bar apart in Ireland, flew it over, and basically built it in place, built it back in place.
That's pretty hardcore.
The people are nice. They're mostly Irish people, with Irish brogues that sound better than yours, I'll tell you that. And surprisingly,
I think that depends on what your definition of better is.
And surprisingly,
I'll bet they're not as humorous as I.
They're cuter than you are, I'll tell you that much. And the Guinness is delicious. The people are very nice. And the food is good. You can out and get a good meal there. And so a lot of people from Jersey, you know, use Penn Station to get in and out of Manhattan or go to Madison Square mm-hmm. Garden a lot. Tiernanog looks like it might be, you know, not a real place. And also on nights when there's not stuff going on at the garden.
At the garden.
They have Irish music, traditional Irish music that sets up. And that is just a very real, very place. But I also point to St. James Gate. You want to talk about the next topic?
Sure, let's do a little quick in the news thing.
A little less happy. Ernest and Giulio Gallo quietly announced, you'll understand why they quietly announced in a moment, quietly announced last week that they're making a recall of their Redwood Creek brand in Japan. Why, you may ask? Well, it's only due to this little thing, this is why they're keeping quiet, due to the possibility of, small glass particles in the wine.
And mostly we don't like to eat or drink small glass particles.
Now, to be fair to E&J Gallo, glass was found in only 2 of 19,000 bottles tested, and Gallo spokesperson Susan Hensley declined to answer questions like how the problem was detected, even though she said no consumers complained, nobody was hurt, no problem. Well, how did they figure out that there was glass in the bottle?
Maybe it was not a consumer.
Exactly. Anyway.
That's one of those things. Very dangerous. Glass is a dangerous material when it starts chipping and breaking in food. And one of the things we do in the restaurant business is we are very, very, very careful. Matter of fact, even on the hotline when the chef is preparing food, no glass is allowed to be on the hotline.
Right. They drink out of plastic cups.
The chefs drink out of plastic cups.
Yeah. Well, they say that no consumers were hurt, and it only affects the wine in Japan. So, and that's been recalled, and so everything's cool with that. All right, so we're going to go and have a pint of Guinness. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And today our guest is Nick Fauchold. He's the Senior Associate Editor at Food & Wine Magazine, one of our favorite publications.
Nick, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
We're doing great. You know, you've written an article about something we talked about a number of times, but I wanted to go a little more in-depth with it, and I really liked the article that you wrote with Ratha Tepp in Food & Wine about locavores. What the heck is a locavore? Why don't you tell our audience?
Well, thanks a lot. I'm glad you enjoyed the story. A locavore is someone who has decided to eat food grown and produced within a 100-mile radius of their home. as much as possible. This whole movement started out in California a few years ago. And it's always been a philosophy that many cooks have had, especially those in areas where, you know, food is abundantly grown around them. But a few people got together in California just a few years ago and decided to present a challenge to themselves and their friends to eat only food only grown within a 100-mile radius for a month. And this started, the first challenge was in August 2005, and they called it the Eat Local Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And about 200 people participated. And since then, this whole movement's exploded. I mean, it's spread around the country, around the world. People are forming web communities and sharing their experiences, and it's a really fascinating movement that's going on here.
One of the things that I do find that's interesting about it is there are varying degrees here of how to be a locavore, I guess. Can you talk to us about those, the different levels of people who declare themselves locavores?
Sure. Well, yeah, there are varying degrees. Some people, you know, take it incredibly seriously and won't use coffee or sugar or anything that's not produced around them, or they make their own. One guy in California makes his own salt because he can't find salt produced in his 100-mile radius.
Squeeze some beets and get some sugar? Is that kind of the
idea?
Yeah.
It's amazing. Other people take it, and most people don't take it quite that seriously, which is fine. There's a rule that they throw around called the Marco Polo rule, which means you can carry or you can use spices in your kitchen that sailors might have carried on the ships, things like cinnamon and paprika, and other locavores are using flour and sugar and salt, and it's really no problem. There's no judging going on here. It's really just an effort to eat as locally as you possibly can.
I read the article, and I thought the Marco Polo rule was where you close your eyes and you try and touch it. Anything you can touch, you can
and
eat.
You end up with cayenne pepper
Or you turn off the lights and you have Marco Polo service, you know. Marco Polo. Anyway.
Yeah.
But there are two different ways that I see this locavorism, locavoraciousness, there are two ways that I see this.
I think it's locavotion, actually.
The expressions of locavorism is locavism. One is I see people who do it for a month very strictly to make a point, I think, to themselves and to others. And then there are others who really take it to an extreme and try and live this way all the time. What, you want to talk about those
sure.
two different uses of locavism?
Sure, or locomotion.
Locomotion.
You know, trying it out for a month is a great way to test the waters and see if it's something that you can do. And certainly in parts of the country where you're surrounded by farms and fields and rivers, it's a lot easier than, you know, where I'm from Minnesota, and in the wintertime Minnesota, there's really not much growing on the ground.
Ice. You grow a lot of ice in Minnesota.
Yeah. Ice fishing is
all
you got.
You get sick of eating ice and the fish that come from underneath it. So, trying it out for a month is a good way to get into it. And what a lot of people have found that, you know, the things they learn in that month become part of their permanent diet, whether or not they still consider themselves a locavore or they still follow the guidelines that strictly. Everyone ends up eating more locally and being more aware of the food that's produced around.
Well, I think it's like a lot of things. You know, we eat foods, we grab foods that without really thinking about them sometimes, without thinking that, you know, I just grabbed a tomato and it's March. Maybe it's came from very, very far away.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the thing I remember when you can, and I think you can do it in a number of ways. We in our restaurants try to buy from local farmers. We contract with local farmers at the beginning of the season to get the produce we want, from the land, which is interesting way that I think the fine restaurants go. And a great thing that restaurants are doing, and people are trying to eat more locally or to have a larger portion of their diet come from locally grown stuff. But to take a month and say, I'm not eating anything that comes from 100 miles away for this, more than 100 miles away for this month, it raises awareness of exactly where your food is coming from. Because
sure.
you may not even think, you know, oh, yeah, I try to eat locally whenever I can. But things like coffee and chocolate and sugar and vegetables in the wintertime, They come a long way.
And a lot of these things just are simply never produced in this area, so there's no way to grow coffee in New Jersey. There just isn't, you know, there aren't very many coffee plants in
yeah.
New Jersey.
The locavores have come up with these guidelines that they have a website, locavores.com, and they've come up with some really good guidelines that that lay it out. If you can't find something that's locally produced, then buy something that's organic, even if it comes from, you know, more than 100 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't find something organic, then find something that was produced on a family farm somewhere else. If you can't find something from a family farm, then...
Then
buy
it's time
from
for
a locally owned business.
then it's time for
then buy from Nabisco. Right, after that is
then
your last.
Then go for the Pop-Tart.
I want to talk about planning when we come back, if that's all right, Nick.
We'll be back in just a moment with Nick Fauchel of Food and Wine Magazine. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or catherinelombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. So Stage Left at Capital Party Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest today is Nick Fauchel, who's the Senior Associate Editor at Food & Wine Magazine. We're talking about eating locally and locavores who can eat exclusively local products.
You know, Nick, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about in getting you on the show was a lot of the things that the locavores are doing. And again, there's not a lot you can do about sugar and coffee and certain ingredients, olive oil, things that just simply don't grow in the climate of New York, New Jersey. But there are other things that a lot of these locavores are doing and where they plan, you know, in the summertime for some of the foods that they're going to be eating in the wintertime. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Certainly. Studying this whole movement's really helped me appreciate the art of pickling and canning and freezing. And you really, it really helps if you can plan ahead. And, you know, when there's is a lot of local food in abundance, you can...
Well, to succeed in this movement, you have to plan ahead. You can't just live...
If you live out here, definitely. If you live in California, in the Bay Area, you know, you have local produce all year long. And it's a much easier task. But, yeah, in cold climates like we're in... definitely need to plan ahead.
Well, but you know what I think is very interesting about that is I think there's a confluence there with what's going on in fine dining. You go and visit Mario Batali's places, or you go to some of these great chef's places, and you will find Blue Hill at Stone Barns, Barber's Cuisine, is using these artisanal methods of preserving and putting up. We ourselves, we contract with a farm in the beginning of the summer to buy thousands of pounds of Jersey tomatoes to put up to make our tomato sauce all year long whenever we can. You know, this locavore thing about eating locally requires you to make your own. And when people start to do this, I think that we see that the food is better.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely not a new concept. People have been making food ahead and preserving it, you know, for hundreds of years because they had to, and convenience has become big in our society that we forgot the art of preservation.
I think that's exactly what's happened. You know, our grandparents did a lot of preserving, but our parents had kind of everything at their fingertips. That someone was canning for them, as it were.
Right.
Campbell's was making their soup for them. And you know, we kind of skipped a generation now, and hopefully our generation is kind of taking that mantle back.
I don't think there's a lot of canning going on outside of the kitchens of great restaurants, but I think it is coming back, and it's certainly appreciated. We'll be back in just a moment talking with Nick Fauchel of Food & Wine Magazine. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
We're talking today with Nick Fouchold. He's the Senior Associate Editor at Food & Wine Magazine, one of our favorite food publications. And we're talking about eating locally, and specifically a phenomenon called locavorism, where locavores try and eat only local food, whether for a month to make a point or to have as much of their food come locally as possible, and how this is a movement that, you know, it's an extreme example of where food is going today. I want to throw out to you, Nick. There are a number of food critics who have of late complained about the fact that when you go to restaurants today, when you go to great restaurants today, they'll often give you the name of the farm where the vegetable was grown, or give you the name of the right. cheese where the cheese was
made. Or the blueberry farm where the honey was harvested.
Yeah, now, and we're guilty of that as anybody. I think that's related to this whole thing. I think that that's not a passing fad. I think that if you want to eat, people want to know where their stuff came from, especially at the high end. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think the farmer-chef collaboration, you know, isn't anything brand new. Definitely has become more popular, at least pushed into the spotlight more in the last few years. You know, personally, I don't have a problem when I go to a restaurant to find out, you know, the name of the lamb I'm eating, or the fact that the carrots came from
Farmer John's farm. I don't want to know that it's Bill, you right. know, Bill yeah. the lamb, but the farm from which it came.
Well, I also think, though, but I think that the criticism of it, and I'll play devil's advocate for a moment, the criticism of it that's leveled out there is it's too fussy, it's too much, it's too verbose on a restaurant menu. And let's talk about restaurants for a moment. Whereas I think it's useful, and I think it's great. And if you stop putting it on the menu, chefs are going to stop doing it because look, when you try to buy locally, it's more expensive.
And harder. More time-consuming. Much more time-consuming.
So I think that, you know, I think that it's a valid thing to say. Talk to me about the expense of locavores. Are these people spending more or less, do you think, than people who are eating processed foods?
Well, it depends if you're talking about spending money or, you know, the real cost of, the ingredients that have been flown from halfway around the world is not necessarily paid for by yourself, but by... the environment pays a big price. I mean,
mm-hmm.
If you add up the gas miles needed to truck a tomato from Chile to your grocery store, it is pretty costly. You might be able to get it more cheaply than a locally grown tomato, but if you add up the net cost of all this, you know, it's somebody ends up paying the price for this.
You know,
the planet.
I think what we've learned recently is we all end up paying the price for this.
Well, and the other thing is, look, that tomato is never going to be as good as a locally grown tomato because it has to be picked a week and a half before it's ripe because it takes a week and a half to get here.
Right.
Now, I just want to throw out there statistics for you all in listener land. The average American miles traveled for American food, for something you put on your plate, is 15 to 2,500 miles for every, you know, if you average everything you eat. And that's up 25% since 1980. So I think that this is really a backlash to a movement in the other direction.
Definitely.
Well, I think also the other problem is, you know, we talked about some of those other foods, okay? And if I want to get olive oil from Italy, and there's a value to that because it's a very special product that I can't get from nearby. Okay, there's a value to that. If I want to buy Australian wine because there's something special about Australian wine that I bring to the table, there's a value to that. But
if your corn is cheaper in Guatemala,
if your corn is cheaper because you know the labor is cheaper in Guatemala to grow corn than it is to grow it in New Jersey on a New Jersey farm. There's a problem there, and we're talking about two very, very different issues.
Definitely. And locavores, all of them would agree with you on that completely.
Do you know the other thing that I think is very interesting? We touched on it earlier about putting food up. We put up tomatoes in the restaurant. We were going to put up a lot more vegetables this summer. We're expanding our relationships with our farmers here in Jersey. You know, a lot of my foodie friends are making their own vinegars. They're experimenting with old methods of food production. Like I have one chick that I know is she's into making fermented foods. Like she partially ferments vegetables and stuff in the canning, which is slightly different than normal canning. But they're amazing flavors. Mm-hmm. That you know, it is more work, and you have to have a house where you have a cellar where you can throw this stuff down.
Yeah. I mean, we have another friend who makes Calvados apples, and you know, you use the Calvados for one thing and the apples for something else when after they come out. And so just some interesting, really interesting things coming from.
See, this. To me, this is. I mean, look, I don't want to be a locavore. I don't want to be 100% locavore. But I think that the idea is that it raises awareness overall to where you can incorporate more of that into your diet. Do you see this, Nick, increasing as time goes on, or do you think it's going to fade, or do you think
I definitely think it's going to increase. I mean, the numbers alone just for this 1 month a year Eat Local Challenge have gone up many, many 100% in 2 years. And actually, in working with these guys on this story, they decided to make their Eat Local Challenge this year in the fall, pushing it back a bit so it's not quite as easy to find a lot of locally grown produce. And I'm talking about doing one in the wintertime, too, based spring from this article.
Well, again, you need to plan to do that. You have to jar and pickle and roast things in advance and freeze things, or in New York, New Jersey, you simply there aren't enough food choices to have. I mean, again, in California, it's a different issue where 11 months a year you can have pretty much anything you want.
The locavore in San Francisco has an advantage over the locavore in Saskatchewan. You know what I'm saying?
But you'd be amazed what you can still find, you know, in the middle of the winter if you go to the farmer's market. There's still enough there to cook a completely well-rounded.
Like what kind of stuff in a temperate place like we are can you find in December and January in the local market? What do these people look for?
You know, a lot of root vegetables, winter greens. And, you know, there are a lot of local farmers, too, that have greenhouses and cold cellars. So they keep things that, you know, they've grown earlier in the year, and they can keep them and preserve them better than you can at home throughout the winter. So they'll bring, you know, they'll ration their stocks up and bring them to the market on a weekly basis. So you can get enough. You know, I've been going to the market a lot lately and still finding some great stuff.
Well, you know, we find it much easier in the summer to do, but I'm a big fan of putting stuff up overall. I think this article was great, and we're going to direct people out there to a couple of websites where you can find it. You can go to locavores.com or eatwellguide.org or foodroots.org or localharvest.org. We'll put all that up on our website. And, Nick, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us on the Restaurant Guys.
Thanks very much for having me.
Nick, thanks very much.
You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.